Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. Readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already matured.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear, no fear. Why? Because it's a choice. You know, and you don't do anything that, you know, even if they come pounding on you, beating you with a stick, you know, arresting you, doing whatever. I mean, should you have fear? Well, it depends. You know, I don't advocate anybody doing any of this kind of stuff unless you got a videotaper of them videotaping with the videotaper of the guy videotaping of the guy videotaping videotape. Because I'm telling you, you know, if you don't have, and it hasn't been until you started having everybody with a smartphone and an immediate put it up on quick kind of streaming on the web, you know, looky what they're doing, that you really get a feel for what's happening. Because a lot of the public has been propagandized into believing that government is good. And if we didn't have it, what would you have? You would have what, you know, freedom. Ooh, that's scary. We don't want that, you know. So what we're going to do is today on this hour, we have a gentleman, and we'll go by his initials are John Blue. And we'll have, and he's a trainer of police officers for years, martial arts expert and firearms, whatever. You know, this is how you're going to arrest him. Just put him on the ground, get him to comply or die. Kind of, you know, this is what he's been doing for a long time. Had his son, West Point graduate, was in Iraq. He's a captain, you know, and he was a Kool-Aid drinking individual, you know, but then it just starts to wear on you after a while. I mean, if you're just seeing the kinds of people that come through the ranks and they keep changing the standards to let more subpar individuals get through. We're going to talk about that a little bit. But first, let me introduce you to Nick Barnett from Cop Block. And I'm going to let him just tell you a little bit about Cop Block and give his promo where you can go find all the goodies. And you hear him a lot on LRN.FM in their Cop Block Police Accountability Report. So let's go ahead and have Nick tell us about that a little bit. And I'm going to let him, you know, ask a lot of the questions and kind of grill him. And there's a lot of things that I want to get to. But let's go ahead and say hello to Nick. Hi, Nick.
How's it going?
Now, go ahead and tell us about Cop Block.
Well, Cop Block is a decentralized project supported by a diverse group of individuals united by a shared goal of police accountability, education of individual rights, and dissemination of effective tactics to utilize while filming police.
While filming?
Yes.
Got to have that filming part.
While filming police.
Okay. Let's go ahead and go to John. John, you know, they like being filmed. They scream and, you know, I remember, go ahead and tell us about when you go into a room or you have another officer there and so on, somebody's got a gun, man, they're screaming gun. You know, what else are they screaming now?
Well, now they are also looking for cameras just as readily as they would be looking for a gun, a knife, or any other weapon. If a secondary officer approaches and he sees a camera, that he doesn't think the primary officer is spotted, he will yell out camera to make sure that the attention is drawn to that.
Why?
I would assume that it is so that the primary officer can adjust his behavior, since that video is very likely to show up in some form of accountability later.
You know, early on, now we're not going to be showing John on camera because he prefers not, so he can freely discuss things without repercussions. But the one thing that I want to make sure people understand is this. In the first years, when this first started happening, especially when 4409 and so on was doing things, they didn't care. They look at camera, I whiz on your camera. Okay. Until after several times of them being made examples of, then all of a sudden policies changed. Now, I want you to go ahead and explain to us your, I guess, what would it be? An epiphany, you know, an awareness? It's, I mean, you, let's go back to 9/11, all right? I'll bet I'm chest-beating, flag-saluting individual, yes?
Yes, I was. I would say at that point, I would have, had I been a younger man, I would have looked for a path into the military myself. I would have been ready to go over and seek vengeance against whomever the government told me was the appropriate enemy.
And you, I'm sure you encouraged your son. He went to West Point. I mean, he's not a slacker.
That is correct. And he was actually in the first class to actually be selected and chosen after 9/11. So, yes, that's accurate.
So he went to Iraq.
Yes.
Does he have warm, fuzzy feelings about his service there?
He does not.
Well, did that have an impact on you, your son, you know, given his perspective? Or what kind of started to extricate yourself from this mindset?
Well, my son and I see things very similarly. And unfortunately for me, of course, he seems to progress at a much younger age than I have. But each of us read much of the same material. We came to the same realizations that government really isn't solving anything, that the money being spent, Iraq, of course, is a great great example. Anybody could spend hours going on all the money being wasted there. But I would say my own personal experience, I noticed more and more that rights seemed to just be a word. They didn't seem to be anything that was recognized as valid by anyone, certainly not by the police and definitely not by the government as a whole.
Okay. Tell us about your experience at being a trainer. Now what you did is in an eastern state, you're up there training people to be line officers, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Now, while you did that, the type of people you would get, did you see them change in their character and their fitness and the kind of people that were being put on the front lines? And who made the decisions of what kind of people they were and what kind of input did you have in selecting, you know, this guy, not this guy, you know? So give me that process.
Okay. That is probably the one thing that had the largest impact on my decision to not continue in that job. I spent over a decade training police officers. I would say a conservative estimate is that I've trained 800 or so. I noticed very early on that most of the police recruits seemed to be physically fit. I could tell that some departments took their hiring process a little more seriously than others did. And in fact, I knew before a class started which department would send kind of substandard or questionable recruits and which ones would send their better people. Over the years, I noticed a trend, and this was not, this is not just my opinion. This is an absolute fact that was shared by many, many instructors in different areas of expertise. We noticed the recruits were softer, whether it be physically or mentally softer. We noticed they would complain more about minor injuries, and I'm talking about a scratch that a Barney Band-Aid would cover up. We noticed that the physical requirements had to be dropped, because otherwise we would just have to fail too many recruits. So,
well, what about drug usage and stuff too?
Yes, well,
I mean, if you're a young person now, I never take a polygraph. I never touch marijuana. That would be bad. You know, did that change too?
Yes, absolutely, it did. A lot of departments had very strict policies when I first started doing the training, and I don't know to tell you exactly how many drug usages they would allow. That varied from department to department also. But I know that increased over time, increased as in the allowable usages, and not only, say, the number of times you could have smoked marijuana, it also went up to X number allowable usages of cocaine and other other drugs.
Now, a lot of the recruits, as they were coming in, I would imagine you probably got a lot of military guys.
Yeah, absolutely. They are preferred by most departments.
Why?
I believe that a lot of the, probably a lot of the higher personnel, a lot of the administration and departments, they seem to be ex-military themselves. So if you have a chief or the major, lieutenants, and so forth that are Marines, they probably would prefer to hire other Marines. It's kind of a esprit de corps type thing. But a lot of the departments feel that ex-military guys are far more easy to direct. They take direction easily, and I can tell you honestly, they're easier for me to train.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. They're already halfway there. Halfway there to what? You know, what kind of people do we have at the tip of the spear? As Jack McLam would put it, I remember, you know, he's an officer friendly from Phoenix, man. He went, police and military against the New World Order. They didn't like that done too much because he understood the tip of the spear for this tyranny is going to be done by the people on the line.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. With me, Ernest Hancock, here from Phoenix, Arizona, in the BEA beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com, which is moving. Yeah, in the next couple of months, we're moving. Yeah, you know, we're going to, you know, on the Lone Prairie, where we're going to start getting ready to leave, so we're ready. Because all this stuff just keeps getting worse. Now, is it getting better? Let me think. No. So we need to decide. Well, a lot of this we saw coming a long time ago, and it had a lot to do. We could see here in Phoenix, Arizona, they would have billboards. I think they still do. Billboards all over the city. Be a policeman. Yeah, you want to be a police officer. You want to be a prison guard. You want to work for Homeland Security. You want to. Because. And a lot of people did. And we knew that, you know, a lot of us have friends, and you have friends that have kids and kids' friends and so on. They go in, and you're going, wow, man, they're giving that guy a badge? You know, he was a butthead, needed to be kicked out of school back in the day anyway. So the quality of character, the quality of a person, and they would determine quality of character in a different way. They would go, you know, your quality of character is you were a Marine, and you learned how to kill people and break things. And we're going to put you in. You got a nice big barrel chest. We're going to put you in here and give you a gun and go do the will of the man. All right. Well, you know, when you saw this go from peace officer, which started happening even when I was young, from peace officer to law enforcement, and there's a difference. There's a difference in mindset. And if it's the law, I'm enforcing the law. Well, you know, I maybe I don't want to judge Dredd out there, you know, being judge and jury, but, you know, they are. They just make it up as they go along. And I'm sure we'll get confirmation of that from the trainer. But first, I want to go to Nick. You know, he's got a lot of guys, you know, cop block. He said, hey, man, I'm going to have this guy. We're going to ask some questions. So I'm going to let him just go ahead and do some questions here. Nick, go ahead and do it, man.
Okay. A lot of people wanted to know what you did before you were a defensive instructor at the police academy and maybe how you ended up working with the police academy.
Okay, I started out as an amateur boxer when I was very young. Then I moved into martial arts. I was very big into martial arts, and two of my primary instructors were former police officers and also former police trainers. So that kind of led me down the path where I ended up being recruited, so to speak, to follow in their footsteps and take over as a police instructor.
Okay, so you were the police instructor. Were you the police instructor? Did you have people working under you? Obviously, you probably didn't come in very high. Did you work yourself up or go into that for me?
Yes, we only had usually two, three at the most instructors at any given time. Of course, I did come into the bottom. I was the assistant defensive tactics instructor initially, and eventually I moved to the position where I was the primary defensive tactics instructor.
So you said the quality of recruits was one of the big reasons you started to change your mind and the lowering of the standards. Was there a common pattern that emerged with lowering of standards? Like how did the jurisdictions start lowering their standards?
Well, some of this is going to be personal opinion. One thing I noticed is a lot of nepotism. It seemed to be very common to find out that a substandard recruit was the nephew of the chief's wife or something like that, or in some cases it was the son of a judge or son of a mayor. I saw this very frequently. And the common thread that I saw with that is it seemed like every time I found out some fact like that about a recruit, it was because he was a poor recruit to begin with. And when I tried to either have him remediated in some fashion or maybe even suggested that he just didn't belong there, I was informed, well, we have to be careful because this is Judge so-and-so's son or the chief's nephew, and we really can't do anything. We're going to have to get him through. Now, what I did notice on the whole is just a plain physical weakening of the recruits that came in. I believe that a strong man, whether he's strong physically, strong mentally, or hopefully both, is much less likely to be a bully than someone who's of weak character. And what I saw were some very weak individuals, weak character, weak physically, and then they were passed through the academy, which became almost like a McDonald's academy, in my opinion, and they were given the power of the state, they were given authority, a gun, and no accountability.
Okay, now there's one thing I want to bring up on this. About 10 years ago, late 90s, early 2000s, so on, before 9/11, there was a story of a state police officer that applied. Well, he wasn't an officer yet. He wanted to become highway patrolman or something. And what he did is Connecticut, wasn't it? We had talked about it. I think it was Connecticut, where he applied and filled out and did all the testing and everything. And he's a smart guy. You know, he wanted to do that. He wanted to serve. I mean, he's of the right mind, he thought. And he went in and he said, why is it you hired this guy, this guy, and this guy, which I know to be subpar, and I didn't qualify? What the heck? And the response was, you're too smart. And they made the argument, and it went to suit and everything. That's when you get your government number, you know, there's a lawsuit, and it hit the internet. And is even though it was kind of, you know, smaller back then. But what happened was all of a sudden we became aware of the idea that law enforcement and different municipalities and state police and so on thought that if you had too high an IQ, you wouldn't be a good officer because you wouldn't take orders. You start thinking for yourself. And we go, yep. And that's when we started paying attention. Yes, they don't want you to be an intelligent individual out there actually taking your oath of office seriously and serving the public and being a peace officer. Heck no. You are just a cog in the machine. You are the tip. You just do what the hell we tell you. Well, you know, do you remember when that happened?
Yes, I do remember when that happened. I remember reading several reports about that particular case. I don't know of any particular department that I dealt with that had an intelligence test per se. But I do know that many of them use psychological examinations, and they sent recruits to meet with psychologists and were interviewed quite extensively. What I suspect is that, just as you mentioned, that they were looking for recruits who would take orders, not question orders. And, of course, that goes perfectly hand in hand with the fact that they prefer military veterans.
Okay, another question for the break.
Well, so the military veterans, what was the main reason that they wanted to go work for the cops? I know you touched on it a little bit before, but we talked a little bit earlier about the adrenaline rush that they might have got over in the combat areas.
Yes, there were downtimes during training where I would ask recruits different questions like the generic ones. Why did you want to become a police officer? What do you hope to accomplish? And that sort of thing. And what I found was a trend the last 3 or 4 years that I instructed. I found that many of the veterans told me specifically that they wanted to go on SWAT teams. That was their number one answer. And when I questioned them, why do you want to be on SWAT? And they made it very clear that they had gotten comfortable and enjoyed kicking in doors in Iraq, pushing people around, and basically being the men in charge. So they were looking forward to doing that here.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, next question.
Did you have the
next? Gotta wait. Going into the break. So you can see this is a rare, nothing surprising, I'm sure, but from someone that's dealing with these people. And then when we come back, we'll get some more questions from Nick. But I talked to John yesterday, and there were some other things. You have the officers, they know them, and they start telling them how it really is after training. and what kind of training they get when they're going on their ride-alongs with their supervisors.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Yeah, some silver bullets. Yeah, silver bullets are coming. Nick and I, we're putting up all the goodies. Walletvoting.com. I wouldn't drink that on there. That'd be bad, right? You know, what we want to do is make sure that, you know, this silver thing, we're not done yet. You know, we're kind of done, but we're going to have some fun with that and just educate the people on, yeah, just go to walletvoting.com. You'll start seeing what's going on. Now, you know, the one thing I did want to do before we got to more of Nick's questions was, to kind of, you know, we'll, in the last segment, we'll do it. You know, we'll start talking about, you know, why you're coming out. I mean, this has to be corrosive. Once you start to understand the truth, you're like, we know the truth. At least we want to know the truth. A lot of people don't. You know, they just want to advocate whatever their position is, make themselves feel better. But a lot of times when you're in using rhetoric and conversation, anybody challenges you, and certainly you start to get some education, you're going, man, you know what? I think I might be the bad guy. Because you go up and you say, you know, there are those that just want to be left alone, those that just won't leave them alone. And I ask, you know, which one are you? Well, he's training the won't leave you alone people. They had to eat at him a little bit. We'll get into that. So let's go ahead and go to Nick. Another question.
Did you have the power to fail someone?
Well, initially, when I first started as an instructor, I was able to fail people, yes. I had to sign off on every single recruit that they had actually passed my block of instruction. So it was up to me to actually put my signature on a piece of paper and say, yes, this guy has successfully completed the defensive tactics training as outlined in the guidelines. As time went on, that ability was taken away more and more, to the point that in the last couple of years, I could give input, I could refuse to sign the paper, but somebody would sign it and they would get passed.
So earlier we talked about how the standards of officers fell, and I know that I have the same perception of an officer as being a jackbooted male thug cop. What about the women? Did they have the same decline in abilities, and did you see a fall there as well?
I would have to say that I did, but keep in mind that the percentage of female recruits was extremely low compared to the number of male recruits, and actually that same statement applies to minorities as well. We had very few minorities that I saw complete training, but one interesting statistic, I kept track of this stuff over time, over what percentage of people passed, what percentage failed, and all that. I just kind of did it on my own. And I did notice that one of the last classes, the percentage, and not the number, of course, but the percentage of female recruits who successfully completed the academy was higher than the males.
You know, do women make better line officers? I mean, from our perspective, as the citizenry.
I honestly can't say that they do or do not. I really don't know. I would say they would be less likely to be macho and probably a little more even tempered. And I can tell you one thing I observed in training is that female recruits, by and large, were easier to train than males.
You know, it's one thing. I'm wondering if it's because of their lack of ability to be pushing people around. They're trying to seek other alternatives, but you know, does it make them more vulnerable also?
That could be the case. I will tell you, though, a couple of trends I noticed was some of the physically weaker recruits, and I'm not just speaking of a small woman. It could be a small man or a slight man of some type. They were more apt to go to escalate force. They would be more apt to immediately jump to a chemical weapon or a impact weapon or something like that when possibly it wasn't needed.
Napoleon complex.
Yeah,
well, I think they'd probably just feel more threatened.
Yes, yeah. That is correct. I believe that they felt more threatened more quickly.
Next question.
Were you able to form a view that the police might have held towards the public, and what was their general view towards individual rights?
Yeah, okay, that's a good one. The public is, as a whole are referred to as civilians by the police, which would imply to anybody that's been in the service that the police, therefore, must be the military. So, yes, we are referred to as civilians, and there is very much an us-and-them mentality that is ingrained in police from the early days of the academy, and that pretty much goes on their entire career.
No, everybody is an enemy. Stand up, Nick. I want them to see your shirt. Everybody's an enemy of the state. Especially some people that are labeled. Okay, go ahead, next question.
Any disturbing trends that you witnessed while training police, and did they have any idols?
Any idols? Yeah, that's an interesting question, yes, because remember, I'm from back east, and something that struck me pretty funny was when I noticed that the police academy, one of the administrators put a picture of Joe Arpaio up on the wall. And even though there was quite a distance, but they pretty much idolized him as
America's toughest sheriff.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I got plenty of Arpaio stories. All right, next question.
What kind of request did you get from officers for specific training? Like, did they request anything special? Like, I want to know how to hurt this guy really bad. I want to know how to break this guy's arm.
Well, when the recruits are new and before the instructor and recruit relationship is really explained to them very thoroughly through the use of push-ups and other inducements, they are more inclined to ask questions like that. They'd come up and ask the typical, how do you kill somebody with one strike, or what's the deadliest type of strike, or something like that. And I would usually just kind of ignore that, and I would let them know that they needed to do 50 push-ups and think about not asking questions like that in the future. But yes, they did come up.
Wow. Okay, Nick.
What's your experience with tasers and how they were used by the police?
Okay, well, I was doing this job when tasers became really widespread. And I never became a taser instructor. I never had any real desire to, but I did volunteer to be tased. And I can tell you it's certainly not a fun experience. But when the tasers were first introduced, they were marketed and adopted as a less lethal weapon, as almost a replacement for a firearm. And I'll give you, for instance, a man with a knife. We often hear stories of a man with a knife that's been shot to death by the police. And everyone later on says, well, why didn't they disarm? Why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? And that is exactly the type of case where the taser was first marketed, was that, hey, here's a way you can handle a dangerous suspect with a knife or a similar type weapon without actually killing the person. Now they've moved up to where tasers have become pain compliance, in my opinion.
So did you ever hear any stories about cops misusing their tasers?
Oh, absolutely.
Cattle yeah. prod. Oh, we're just livestock. Cattle prod. Go ahead and tell us about it.
Okay. Well, I had it's kind of a funny story. I remember one department in particular that had purchased quite a large number of tasers. And while the tasers were new, like any other new tool, they became a toy of sorts. And the way the story went was that one of the officers was at a party where, of course, alcohol was being consumed. And he decided to show off and took his taser and shot a raccoon with it. So shortly after that, it was my understanding that he and many of the officers in that department were relieved of their tasers, and they were put in the hands of the supervisors.
So did you ever run into any cops that were on steroids or talked about steroids?
I can't really give you anything on that one. No, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that. And I mean, I could look at somebody and say, I wonder if he's doing this or that, but no, I don't have any information on that one.
Well, tell me about the guys that after you trained them, they would come up to you and they recognize you on the street or say, yo, what's up? And then they would tell you how things were after the academy. Go ahead and talk about, you know, we're going to have to wait. We'll do that when we come back here on Declare Your Independence in just a little bit. Because I want to know that. You know, of course they're going to have the manual. I mean, you're getting all kinds of civil suits and everything. And they go, well, how were you trained? And then they'll bring out the manual. They'll bring out the trainers and this is what. And they'll try and protect themselves. And we told them the right thing. But where do they get their real training? Well, it's when they first get on the street with somebody and they tell them how it really works. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show.
Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
One mission. What's that mission here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock? You know, if I had to pick one thing, I get to pick one thing. This one thing out there. Can I just know the truth? You know, seriously. Can I just, you know, that be like, oh, I got to tell you this real quick. What really emphasized this for me, I was probably in the early 80s or something. Maybe it was in high school, right after high school. They had a book, it was called Gorky Park, and they later made a movie about it and so on. But there was one scene in there, it was about a detective in Moscow. And the reason he wanted to be a detective is because as a young child, they had a suicide in his apartment building. And they knew it was a suicide, but it was reported as a homicide. Nobody commits suicide in the Soviet Union because we're all happy. It was just propaganda. That was part of it. We don't have suicides here because they had a lot of suicides. So he's going, well, I want to be a detective. Because that's the only way you're going to get to know the truth. Oh, now we have people want to be detectives so they can cover up the lies. You know, this, I mean, we are sick, 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 sick. Is it more than the Soviet Union that officers are worse? Maybe not. But, you know, I'm looking at a lot of these trends. Now, we're going to get a couple more questions from Nick, and then we'll get into, you know, why John has made this shift and how that happened. You know, I was talking to him off air. He read Atlas Shrugged as a young man. I'm going, how the heck did you ever even get this far, you know, into this stuff? So we'll talk about that. But let's go ahead and go to Nick with final questions.
Do you think there's anything that general public can do to reach cops that are have this thuggish mentality or help them realize that they're on the wrong side or is kind of a lost cause?
Don't talk to cops.
Yeah, just don't talk to them.
The short answer would be no. I don't think there's anything they can do. Probably the best recourse the public has is to use their cameras and make them accountable.
So the best way to hold them accountable, you think, is using the cameras?
Absolutely. I believe, I can't recall who made the statement, but that the camera is the new gun, but I do believe that that is very true.
Do you think that there's any... Do you think that privatizing any police forces would have any use on it so they could respond to market signals?
Yeah, I want to hire me.
Yeah.
I rule me. I've got to get a shiny badge. You know, my in-laws got me in Tombstone. It says shiny badge. No. It says stinking badge. That's what it was. Stinking badge. You getting a stinking badge? I got my stinking badge. I'll rule me. Thank you very much. Go ahead and respond.
Okay. Yes, I do. I think privatization would be a... The best answer to the problem we face with police today. I think, matter of fact, I think it's the only answer that there is. I don't see why between private, whatever you would call them, defense agencies and insurance companies, I don't see why they couldn't work together to provide those services.
You know, let me ask you this. There was a movie called Cuffs with Christian Slater. I think it was Christian Slater. And it was about San Francisco to where the way the police used to operate, I don't know how they do now in San Francisco, is you had like a private franchise, your own hired personal police precinct thing. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't.
That was interesting. It was called KUFFS, Cuffs, and it was just about him inheriting it from his brother or something. But that was interesting. I didn't even know that existed. I talked to some people about it, and that's how they did it. You got a last question?
Back earlier, you talked about how they're trained now. When they come into a room, if there's somebody that has a camera, they yell, camera, just like if somebody had a gun or a knife. Do you think that would tend to put people on a defensive edge where if I'm walking into a place and I'm a little sketchy about what's going on here, my partner starts yelling, do you think that there might be some sort of just snap judgment training that my partner just yelled, I need to pull my gun and point it at someone?
Yeah, I think what you're asking about is escalation, basically. And if an officer has been trained to respond to signals from his partner or his backup, and he hears a signal, yes, I believe he's going to escalate. I think there's a very good chance of that.
Okay, this is now we can get down in the, you know, get to the end on this thing. Because the reason that I want to have John, you know, he had come by, he's looking to move to Arizona. We go to Arizona. You know, right when I'm ready to leave. But the other thing, he's coming to Arizona better than wherever he's from in the Northeast, you know, pick your state. Now, we have Nick, happened to be in the office. We're working on some stuff. And Mr. Cop Block. And I'm going, oh, yeah, there's a show. So we have him come in today. And I, and I, And I want to give John the opportunity to express himself fully in that, you know, you have to really take an emotional and intellectual journey that would take you from training the very people that are on the tip of the spear, taking our rights away and violating them, to where you become an advocate again, or just want to extricate yourself from the whole process and start advocating for your own soul cleansing or something like that. Let's go ahead and let him express himself on his journey, why, what happened, and so on. And we want to talk about Free Talk Live because, you know, you started listening to those guys. That, you know, that gave you a little bit of a framework to operate from on this freedom thing.
Yes, I think that I approached the instruction initially with no thought. I didn't think about whether it was right or wrong or anything else. It just was a kind of a natural extension of the training that I had already been involved with. So when the opportunity presented itself, I got involved. I was kind of enamored with it. There's a certain amount of prestige that comes with being known as the instructor for the police in any given area. And then at some point I started...
then you start getting blamed.
Yeah, well, then I started waking up a little bit and seeing what was actually what. And then I kind of convinced myself, the same way people say today that they're going to fix the Republican Party from within, that sort of thing. I thought, well, I'm going to have a positive effect on these guys. I'm going to tell them things that no other instructor tells them. I'm going to do something good here. And what I realized over the course of the years is the only thing I was actually doing was I was taking future bullies and making them more effective future bullies.
Mm. Well, did they ever talk to you about, you know, after you went through training and they told you where they got their real training and how that evolution happened?
Absolutely. That is every recruit, when he graduates and is sworn as a police officer, he's then assigned a training officer of some type. And that varies depending on the department as far as whether it's 4 weeks, 8 weeks or whatever, and then also, of course, the performance of the new officer. Well, I would say with 100% certainty that one of the first things the new officer is told by his training officer is, forget everything you learned in the academy, now we'll teach you how we really do it. And the unfortunate thing about that is that I actually worked with a lot of good people in the academy setting. I actually heard things stressed like do not lie, cheat, or steal. I saw ethics pushed quite a bit. I heard the statement, don't lie, testify, many times as a reminder to the future police officers to always be honest in their reports and in their testimony. And I found it quite disheartening to realize that they were told later on, just forget all that. We'll tell you how it really goes.
Wow. So this had to have some kind of a corrosive effect on your own state of mind.
Oh, definitely did. And as I said, it was kind of disheartening to, one, to realize that I was just making future thugs more effective thugs. And then also, it was disheartening for me to pick up the paper on occasion and see men who I had trained previously as recruits who had become police officers who are now being convicted and incarcerated for felonies.
So you decided to what? How is it that you decided to move here? What? And go ahead and tell us about, you know, because I remember you saying something about you started listening to Free Talk Live, and that had an impact on you. Tell us about that.
Well, about the same time that I was kind of coming to the awareness of liberty, coming to that point in my journey, I had think I'd gotten an iPod and just did a search for libertarian on iTunes, and that took me to Free Talk Live. I started listening to those guys, and I thought, wow, you know, there's actually people out there that think the same way as I do. I didn't realize. I thought that, and of course, this is what I had evolved to. This isn't what I was when I first started with the police instruction or anything else. But this was at the very end of my career, so to speak. And after listening to them for a while, I'm pretty much getting the reinforcement that my ideas really were shared by quite a few people. I realized that, you know, maybe I'm onto something here, and maybe I just really don't need to be involved in this anymore. And so I decided that I would have to make penance of some type for it.
Well, it starts here. Undeclare your independence. Make your penance. Get your peace. Get your mind right. You know, this is, you know, all's welcome to learn the truth. You know, I and once you find the truth, what side do you take? because it's all going to come down. You know, this is how I put it. I go, look, there's going to be a guillotine line. You're going to get there's going to be a giant long line, you know, for the guillotine. Well, I sure as heck don't want to be in the line, and I don't want to be at the lever either. You know, I don't care. I'm like, whatever. But I know some people will be in the line screaming, Ernie, save me over here. And I'm going, do they deserve to be saved? How about I just be as far away from the guillotine line as possible, have nothing to do with it, let it go, and protect myself and provide for my family and my grandchildren? That's what I'm doing. You do it too.
This is Ernest Hancock. I'm publisher of FreedomsPhoenix.com and the radio talk show host of Declare Your Independence. Now, I want to give you my personal endorsement of a wealthy U.S. citizen that is predicting that in 2011, we will witness the most important day in America in more than 50 years. He's produced a video for you. It's a real eye-opener, and I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to watch it. www.endofamerica1and7.com. endofamerica17.com. This video has the history of how we got where we are now and where we're going and why. Now, it's a lengthy video. It'll be about 20 minutes, but you need to watch this so you understand what's going to happen to this country and how you can protect your wealth and even benefit financially. Now, you go there. It's free. I want you to watch this video. You need to have this information so that you can survive the economic collapse that's coming to America. It's not if, it's when. That's End of America, the numbers 1and7.com. After you watch it, you'll understand why I endorsed it.